The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Are you longing for a place where hope, ideas, and new ways of thinking can arise? For nearly 50 years, Omega Institute's campus in Rhinebeck, New York, has been a gathering place where world-class teachers provide innovative educational experiences that cultivate extraordinary potential in us all. Join us, either on campus or online. To learn more, visit eomega.org.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Radiate Wellness Podcast with your host, metaphysician, Reiki master, and hypnotherapist, Christy Clemens Hoffman. Each week, we will discover teachings, tips, and tools to radiate your best life ever with practitioners, authors, and luminaries to help you on your path. Wellness, joy, peace, abundance. What do you want to radiate?
Hello, and welcome back to the Radiate Wellness Podcast, where today we radiate hope with Jim Willis, who is the author of Near-Death Experiences, Afterlife Journeys, and Revelations. Hello, Jim.
Hello, how are you? Good to be with you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, I'm glad I could. We almost didn't make it between technical glitches this morning and everything else. I find it somehow very ironic here in the last part of my life that I came out here in the woods to get away from everything and to get away from the hustle and the bustle and to have time to meditate and contemplate and all that kind of thing. And somehow the fiber optic cables seem to follow me. And now here I am out here trying to have more time and get away from all of that. Whereas I used to speak to a classroom full of 50 kids or something like that in a college setting, or a church maybe have 100 people in it. Now, through the great work of people like you and all that you're doing with the community, building community, I find myself talking not to a few people here and there, but to many, many more. And rather than escape technology, I'm afraid I've just had to give into it. I have no idea how you and I can sit here and look at each other and talk with each other, and somehow those digital signals bounce off into space out of some kind of a satellite and go to some kind of a tower and get picked up and radiated all over. And when it works, it's wonderful because it can establish great community. But oh, when it doesn't, it's totally beyond my ability to fix. So I just kind of accept it. It's a very, very ironic time of life for me, I'm afraid.
Where are you located?
Well, I'm out in the middle of the woods in South Carolina. When I was finishing up my career, I was a minister, a pastor of churches for, well, beside being a teacher and a part-time carpenter and a musician for about 40 years. And then when I retired, I discovered something kind of strange. Back in the 20s, when I got out of college, and then I went off to seminary, and I became the pastor of my first church, and I had this crazy idea that somehow getting into ministry was going to be joining this community of like-minded, spiritually minded people who wanted to get together and grow together and learn more about life and learn more about purpose, which we're talking about today. And it just doesn't work out that way. When you become the pastor of a church, even a small church, you're basically becoming a CEO of a small corporation. And as a result, you've got to do all the things that CEOs do. You've got to worry about money. You've got to worry about buildings. You've got to worry about growth. You've got to be a part-time counselor. Oh, part-time counselor, part-time musician, public speaker, all of these things. And somehow the years go by, and 40 of them went by, and I had not really connected with the essence of what I went into ministry for. And here my life is coming to the end. I was 62 years old, and I had had a wonderfully satisfying life, and my spiritual life was such, like most of us, that there were times during meditation or during prayer when I would be Oh, music did it all the time, transported to something beyond myself. But I wasn't living that. And so when I retired, I got to the age of 62 and I could just start to feel my body starting to change. And I was not able to do the things. And I didn't want to wait anymore. I couldn't afford it, but I did it anyway. I didn't want to wait anymore. So I looked around and lo and behold, found myself out here in the woods of South Carolina. And my goal was to come out here, and I'm surrounded. I don't own that much property myself, but I'm surrounded by miles and miles of national of state forest that I can, get out in. So I'm out here, and I often days go by when I don't see or hear anybody. Maybe a plane will fly over, and that'll be about it. And I came out here with a prayer, really, to whom it may concern, because by this time my concept of God was changing. Totally. I came out here with a prayer, and it came from the Bible. It came from the Old Testament book of Genesis, the prayer of Jacob when he wrestled with God and said, I will not let you go until you bless me. Matter of fact, if you look up over this shoulder over here, there's a picture of Jacob wrestling with God that my daughter gave me to kind of remind me of that prayer. And I didn't realize that I was given that message. I didn't just make it up, that particular verse, until a couple of years later, I was asked to go over to Cornwall to speak to a group of people over there about the birth of world religions and the connections of world religions. I'd never been to England before, so I was looking forward to it. I had a wonderful time, great group of people called the Parallel Community, and we had a wonderful time to share, but I couldn't leave England without going up to a little town called Fenny Compton, which was up northwest of London. So I rented a car, learned how to drive on what was to me the wrong side of the street.
Yeah, I don't know if I can do that.
Met my first English, what they call roundabouts. Those big, we call them traffic circles. But anyway, I made it up to Fenny Compton and I was ensconced in a little bed and breakfast. And I met the town historian and she was able to let me into the church in Fenny Compton. And the reason I wanted to go there was because my ancestors, great, 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 I don't know how many greats ago, used to preach in that church. And I was able to actually see his name on the wall, and then Willis, the former pastor of this church that goes back to 1600s and earlier, and actually stand in the same pulpit where he preached. And when I got up there and looked around, I saw a stained glass window, which was most visible from the pulpit. You can look right at it. And I've never seen this particular image in a stained glass window before. But lo and behold, while I stood there in the pulpit of my ancestor, I saw a picture of Jacob wrestling with God, saying to, I will not let you go until you bless me. I want to tell you, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. I had no idea how my great ancestors' spiritual DNA could have been passed down through the generations. But I wonder if he ever realized that his descendant would someday, who had preached in pulpits, would someday stand in that very pulpit with that same prayer in mind, I will not let you go until you bless me. And lo and behold, when I came out here to the woods and lived for 1 year, that was 16 years ago, and I'm still here. But somehow along that line, my prayer was answered. It didn't come through Christianity. It probably couldn't have, because by then Christianity was so much of a habit and thought I was such an expert and all. It came to me through nature. It came to me through probably the oldest religion in humanity, shamanism, and the idea of, oh, I learned how to douse for earth energies, and I discovered the connection with earth, but I also discovered different dimensions and acquired a spirit guide, which frankly I had never really believed in before then, to speak of. And it just changed everything totally. And that's where I am today.
Fantastic. Well, let's switch gears, if we may.
Sure.
I would love to talk about your book, Near-Death Experiences. Why did you choose to write about near-death experiences? Your experience had been vastly different.
Well, I've written a lot of books through, and many of them with Visible Ink Press. And usually my decisions are based on the fact that a publisher will call me and say, we want a book on such and such, and here's your advance money. Will you do it? And I say, sure. But that wasn't the case here. This book goes back 50 years. And when I was just out of school and I was in my 20s and I knew everything, we all did. We all had all the answers in our 20s. And it was in the height of the 70s. And I was on top of all the latest technical stuff and scientific stuff that was going on and exploding into the world into the 70s. And while I was involved in probably the first or second year of my ministry, I forgot which, called to a hospital because a parishioner of mine, wonderful, dear lady named, I call her Hannah in the book. She was in the hospital and she was expected to, that was probably going to be her last stop. It wouldn't be very long. She was in her late 80s at the time. And I would go to see Hannah. I got in the habit of visiting her four or five times a week. And I knew that she loved the old hymns of the church. So I got into the habit of bringing my guitar with me and singing In the Garden or The Old Rugged Cross, and she'd hum along, and sometimes the nurses would roll other patients in, or we'd have a little choir going. It was a lot of fun. But on this particular day, which happened to be the last day I ever saw Hannah alive, I was putting away my guitar, and I was alone in the room, and she said, "What did you bring with you?" And I said, "Hannah, I'm just here by myself." And she nodded and kind of smiled, a knowing smile. And she said, "Oh, they're probably waiting for you to go. I think the music attracts them." Well, I didn't even think music is vibration and energy. I wasn't even thinking in those terms then. I thought Hannah was kind of crazy. And I said, "Oh, you mean after I go, you'll have other visitors?" I looked out in the hallway. She couldn't see out in the hallway because there was a curtain there and she couldn't, but I was standing at the end of her bed. I could look right out in the hall. There was nobody in the hallway. And she said, "Yeah, sometimes after you go, they come through the portal." And I said, I thought she meant door. So I said, "The portal." And she said, yeah, they'll come. Well, I didn't want to disturb this wonderful old woman, you know, and make her more uncomfortable. So I said, "Well, that's good, Hannah. I'm glad you're going to have more company." And I walked out. But on my way out, I stopped by the nurse's station. And I said to the head nurse, "What's Hannah talking about people coming through the portal?" And she said, "Well, she's been talking about that lately, like that lately. I think probably things are shutting down." You know, this was the 70s before hospitals were really studying this kind of thing. It was before Raymond Moody, for instance, had written his famous book, Life After Life, in 1975. "Well," she said, "she's probably shutting down. She probably won't last long." And as it turns out, Hannah died later that night. Well, I was young. I knew all the scientific studies about when the brain shuts down and the blood stops flowing to certain areas of the brain and the neurons stop firing. And I just thought that Hannah was making it all up. And now I look back on that. I confess I'm ashamed of myself. Now, here I was a minister who believed in other dimensional beings. I mean, I would sing Hark the Herald Angels Sing and stuff like that. I preached all that stuff, but I guess I wasn't a believer as much as I was a hoper. I hoped that it was all true, but it wasn't a part of me. I never forgot that time when she said, "Who did you bring with you? They come through the portal." 40 years, 50 years went by. And a couple of years ago, or a year ago, some old friends of mine, parishioners, came, and his name was Bob, and he told me about his mother dying. His mother reminded me of Hannah. She was as sharp as a tack, wonderful old lady. She loved the old hymns of the church, and I would sing with her too, you know, just like I had with Hannah 50 years earlier. And he said, "Well, she passed away," he said, "but I was in the hospital room when she left." And he said, "She said something really strange to me." And I said, "What was that?" She said, "Who did you bring with you?" And whoa. And then she said, "They come through the portal." And she used the word portal again. And those two incidents, 50 years apart, made me look at my own life and my own growth and realize the opportunities that I missed when I was young and thought I knew it all and wasn't open. And I'm now honestly convinced that those people could have taught me so much more. And I think that's one message I try to get across to people because it can change our lives. A while back, I got a call in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, when I was still in active ministry. And a member of my church was in the hospital and he wasn't expected to make it through the night. And so the nurse said, "He's asking for you. Can you come? I know it's 3 o'clock in the morning." I said, "Oh, sure, I can be there." So I put on some clothes, got in my car, and went down to the hospital. And this man was, if you want to look at a successful life in the dictionary, you'd turn to successful life and you'd see his picture. He had two different doctorates, academic doctorates. He had started a university that's still going today. He's a pillar of the church, pillar of the community. Everybody loved him. And I said to him, because he and I were good friends, I didn't have to beat around the bush. I said, Bradley, they tell me it could be close. Are you ready to go? And Brad started to cry. And I'd never seen him do this before. And I said, what is it, Brad? And he said, you know, Jim, he says, I'm not going to kid you. I've lived a good life. I'm happy with what I've done. But the one thing that I missed was the most important thing, and I never did it. And I said, what was that? He said, I never prepared for this moment. And he didn't die that night. Thank goodness we had 10 more days, and I visited him every day before he passed away. And we had talks every day about religion and spirituality and what was like on the other side. And we just meditated together. We prayed together. It was just really great. I don't know whether I taught him anything in those 10 days that I spent with him, but I know he taught me an awful lot. And that's what I kind of wanted to convey. So when you say, why did you write this book? I felt it was important that while I was still here, having had these experiences, I need to share them with other people, because to me, it gives life purpose when you realize this isn't all. There is something bigger than us, something beyond us. That is what brings a real purpose, I think, into people's life.
I think you're absolutely right. When we understand that there's a much bigger picture and we fit in somehow.
Yeah. I've come to the conclusion, really, and it's my own personal conclusion. I don't mean to start a religion or anything like that. I'm not saying this is the way. I don't think there is one way. I think that everyone, we all find our way in, way out and our way through. But I've come to the conclusion in my own life, I'm happy with the idea that we come from what I now call source. I'm not really comfortable with the word God anymore. Not that I'm not comfortable with it. It's just that when I use the word God, I have a meaning that means something to me. But the word God in our culture today has such baggage. I mean,
it's
we just
limited,
use it so loosely. Oh, people just assume that when I say God, I'm meaning the God that they're thinking of. And I'm not happy with that. So
being a minister, I can see that. That's kind of a direction shift for you.
Sure. And especially many people who have had troubles with the church in their youth and have had to leave and everything. When I say the word God, they immediately go back to the God of their youth. And it was a totally different God. You know, the idea that God's going to get you for that. And he knows when you've been sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. And I just can't abide by that, those definitions. So I like to use the word source. And I think we come from source because, well, picture source as the still small point in the center of a circle that's rotating around. It's the still point. It's the point of perfect unity, perfect stillness, perfect oneness, perfect wholeness. What's wrong with that? Why don't we just keep that? Because there's one thing that you can't do in an environment like that, and that's grow. How can you get individual experience when you are part of something that is totally whole and totally oneness, total union? You can't do that. You can't gather individual experience when there's nothing but unity. And so in order to gather that experience to make the source grow experientially, you have to leave the source and travel through dimensions. I like to say we leave the source and we find ourselves in the dimension of what I like to call material reality manifested. It's the idea of being out here on the perception realm. This is a physical place, and we experience it through our five senses. And those five senses form a fence around us. To get here, we have to go through the first dimension that I call consciousness. Both Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking called it the mind of God. That's that first dimension of consciousness, of understanding, of thinking outside the idea of total unity. But to get passed out of that dimension, you have to go through the first field. And that's what Irvin Laszlo, for instance, called the Akashic Field, place of infinite possibilities and infinite potential. And then we find ourselves in the second dimension, which is the quantum dimension, just discovered recently by scientists within the last 100 years through math. I don't think they discovered it. I think they've just simply found another way of finding a dimension that Hindu rishis and yogis and gurus and spiritual people have known about for thousands of years. But it's the place of quantum reality or thoughts and intentions. It isn't yet sure exactly what a human being you will be, but it is obviously what human beings are, I guess. Plato talked about horse and horseness. He said, a horse is just a temporary thing. Horseness is eternal, you know, that kind of an idea. That's what quantum reality is all about. But you're still energy. You still don't have a body manifested. And so you pass through what they call the Higgs field, a newly discovered Higgs field. And in the Higgs field, we are told by scientists that energy slows down. It's like going into a field of molasses. It slows us down and slows down that energy source from the source until we find ourselves in a material reality, in a body, in this perception realm. And there, here we live. And the purpose of this, we're talking about giving life purpose, the purpose of our going through here is that we can become individuals. And as individuals, we can gain individual experience. I think it's a school for us, basically.
Yeah.
We learn how to be an individual. We get ego. And we like to think, oh boy, my life is going great and everything is wonderful when things are smooth. Trouble is, if you're going to gain experience, you just can't gain good experience. You got to gain the other side too, both experiences.
We have to have contrast to the good experiences. You know, we'd never watch a movie where nothing happens to the main character.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's
yeah,
the growth? Where's the development?
Yeah, there's always two sides of a coin, isn't it? And now the quantum physicists are telling us it's even more. Our experience is even bigger than what we have here, because every experience is realized. We flip a coin and it comes up heads and we say, there, that's it. What we don't realize is that with the flipping of that coin, on the other side, there's another us on the other side, flips the coin, it comes up tails. So we're gaining experience over there too. But because we are in our own sense of our own individual sense, our ego thinks that we're the only ones here. We think this is the way it is, but there's another us on the other side saying, no, this is the way it is. So when you put it all together, this is a wonderful place to gather experience. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about bringing purpose into life, because when we are in the midst of bad times, when things are difficult for us, when we're dealing with sickness or relationship problems or job problems, economic problems, and we feel that life is just not worth it, if we can be reminded deep within ourselves that this is why we came, this is one of the things we came to experience, then that gives our life purpose. All of a sudden, we can say, I know it's bad now, but it's not going to last forever. So what do I have to do? Do I try to get away from it? Well, to a certain extent, sure. If you got your hand in a boiling hot water, you're going to want to pull it out. But on the other hand, if you can't, then you say, I'm going to delve into this experience. I'm going to go into my pain. I'm going to feel my pain. I'm going to understand it.
Figure out why I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why am I experiencing this?
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting that the work that I do, I'm a hypnotherapist and I do QHHT hypnosis, and we go to past lives and other lifetimes, really, because I don't really believe in past, because that's time and time is just a construct.
Oh, that's a beautiful way of saying it. Yeah. It could be happening all at the same
moment.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
No matter what we're living through, no matter what we're experiencing now, I guarantee we've been through worse.
Yeah.
We think, oh my gosh, this bankruptcy is the worst thing I can ever possibly imagine. This divorce is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. No, I truly believe that we've been through all of this.
Yeah, and you come across a divorce or a bankruptcy, and then all of a sudden you realize that in another life, you're marching off to the Nazi gas chambers, you know, or something like that. So it does help, I think, to understand that as bad as it is,
all of this, it has been worse. Not that it could be worse, but it has been worse.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And I think that's part of what in near-death experience, I think that's part of what we go through. You know, everybody talks about the tunnel and the light, but also the life review.
Yeah.
I think that's what the life review is. It's going back over our life, not to saying, have you been good enough or have you done bad things? I don't think anybody's judging us. We're looking at the experience that we've had and we're filing it away so that it can be saved forever in what some people call.
Did you learn from it?
Yeah.
Did you learn
exactly.
from it? Did you move through it with grace and peace, or did you hold on resentment?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. And people talk about the Akashic records. I think that's probably what they're talking about. All of our experiences are stored so that when we return to the source, we don't come back empty-handed from this great adventure of life. We come back with all of these experiences, which is exactly what we left the source to get in the first place. That's a pretty good purpose for life right there.
I think so too. You know, I always thought that we are just expressions of God as some source. I mean, I use God as a shorthand.
I understand and I agree.
That we're all aspects of this source that wanted to know more about itself and what it was, what it's capable, mm-hmm. what consciousness really is and what it does. Yeah. And so breaking into the million pieces, each one of us becomes a piece of that, or each one of us isn't that. Finding information, gathering experiences, gathering information to inform us as source who and what we really are.
Yeah. And I know that sometimes my Christian friends tend to, well, that sounds almost like blasphemy when you say you are a part of God. But didn't Jesus say in the New Testament, quoting the Old Testament, what? Know ye not that ye are gods? There it is, right there.
There it is. All that I do, you can do and more.
Yes.
Because you're all gods. Now, let me ask you this, Jim. Where you are now, theologically, where you are now philosophically is so different from where you were before.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get to this? And did you suffer much pushback?
I don't want to take too much of your time, but I would like to ask you a few simple favors. First of all, please rate, review, and share this podcast wherever you're listening. You know, it sounds like a simple little thing, and it is, but it has a huge impact for us because it helps other people find us in the podcasting algorithms. I don't know how it works, but I do know that it helps a lot. Next, if you would subscribe or follow wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube or Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Pandora, Spotify, wherever you're listening, just hit subscribe or follow, and that helps you and it helps us. It helps you because then you receive notifications when we have a new episode that's out. It helps us because, again, algorithm magic, I don't know what happens. But it helps. And then finally, you can support our podcast in a tangible way by going to radiatewellnesscommunity.com/podcast and then click on support the show. Now, we have a new feature too. We are now on Patreon. You can find us on Patreon. You can also find the link to Patreon when you go to radiatewellnesscommunity.com/podcast. So on Patreon, for $3 a month or $5 a month, you can support your metaphysical and spiritual growth. You can learn about upcoming guests, and you can get early and ad-free versions of the shows. So please support us. This podcast is free for you to listen, but we have costs, and quite frankly, they come out of my pocket. So if you like this content, if you get a lot out of it, please see what you can do to give back. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Huge pushback. And when you say, how long did it take me to get here? Well, so far, it's taken me about 50 years. And I suppose I've got more time left to go because I'm certainly not done yet. Did I get pushback? Yes. I still identify with Christianity because it's my home. That's where I was all my life. I understand it. I haven't set foot in a church for 16 years, but I still call myself a Christian. And I have a great confession. I love the music. Not only do I love the great Christian music of Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, I love the contemporary gospel music, Bill Gaither and his stuff and everything. I just love it. And I can sing these songs at the top of my lungs. I may not agree with any of the theology of it, but I just love the music. But there are Christian friends who are very concerned about me. I've lost my way, forsaken my first love, and all this kind of stuff. And they're praying for me, which I think is great. And I'll take all the prayers I can get. But on the other hand, I worry about people who get so stuck in one particular religious outlook that they can't open the doors and breathe the fresh air every once in a while. Because when people say, all this new stuff that you've been into, has that destroyed your faith? And I say, no, it's just made it bigger, much bigger. And now I go back into the Bible, and I find all these things that I never knew were there that are saying this exact same thing. I'm finding the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians had an out-of-body body, a near-death experience when he was taken to heaven and said, I heard things that I can't even express. You know, language can't possibly express them. And you go back into the Old Testament and you find some of these great saints of old, prophets of the Old Testament who had out-of-body experiences and all this kind of thing. And it opens up the Bible so you can read it much differently. I don't find the Bible being any more particular of a holy book than any other religious literature, but I think it's there in all of the different religions when you come right down to it. When people say, do I have to give up my faith if I become a dowser, or do I have to give up my faith if I... And I say, no, just read it in a new way. Find it new dimensions. Listen to the music. Bach once said that no music should be written that's not written to the glory of God. And it's just this wonderful idea of being able to take what is basically vibration, a string vibrating, a kettle drum vibrating, a column of air vibrating through an instrument. And all of a sudden you can be transported. And it's wonderful. You know, say, you don't have to give it up. Just read it in a new way. Look at it in a new way. Experience it. And I guess that's the biggest difference that has changed me. I've gone from reading about to experiencing. And I think that's a journey that if your life can go along those paths, if you can begin to experience what you used to just know about, then your life has purpose, I think.
I think so too, because then you're all of a sudden aware of the bigger picture rather than That's beautiful. So your book, you talk about different aspects of the near-death experience. One of the aspects that you write about is the religious. Mm-hmm. So you talked about out-of-body experiences being found in the Bible, but are there also NDE stories found in the Bible? And what about, you know, other books such as the Book of the Dead and the Talmud and the Quran?
I think the answer is yes, and all of them. They all carry that same idea. You talk about the Quran, how it came to be. I mean, Muhammad went out into the desert to meditate. He went to his cave and his mountain, and he meditated, and he meditated, until all of a sudden, out from another dimension, steps the angel Gabriel, the same angel that appeared in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, the Book of Daniel. And we discover that here, out there in the middle of this angelic being, steps out of another dimension and says, write. And along came the Quran. And in the Quran, one of the things that Muhammad shared was his nighttime journey, where he rode from Jerusalem up to the heights and going through the heavens, having a, if it was not a near-death experience, it was a very powerful out-of-body experience, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And there he was, seeing this. The Hindu rishis, 6,000 years, were writing about this and talking about this. They explained it so well. They had the idea of Brahman and Atman. And Brahman is something that cannot be explained. It's the ultimate God, I suppose, you could say. They don't, but you can't even call Brahman anything, because once you put a word box around Brahman, you've missed it. Brahman is that place where words cannot go, where the tongue cannot touch. When I was first teaching this and at the college level, I wanted to make sure I got it right. So I went to a friend of mine who was practicing in his version of Hindu religion. And he had a little table in his back of his shop where he would light candles and say his prayers. And I wanted to make sure I got the concept of Brahman right. And so I went to see him on the morning when I was going to give this first lecture to my students. And I said, I want to talk to you about Brahman because I'm going to be teaching it this afternoon. And he looked at me and said, Brahman, very difficult subject. And I said, okay, here's what I'm going to say. And I gave him my thumbnail teaching notes. My cliff notes. And he listened, and he was always very excited. He was nodding his head, shouting. And I said, there, did I get it right? And he nodded his head up and down and said, no. it was the best lesson I could have had about you. You can't. But the rishis went on past Brahman to talk about Atman. Atman is the internal. Sometimes in English, we use the word Atman, we use the word soul, but it doesn't really fit soul. But the beautiful thing that the rishis would say was that Brahman out there and Atman in here are one. And they would say those great words in Sanskrit, thou art that. The God who cannot possibly be comprehended is within you, and you are one. I think they really got it right way back. And I'm talking about 6,000 years ago now. So that's just what we were talking about before. So when you ask, is it in the other religions? Yeah, I think it's in all of them. I really do.
Yeah, I think so too. It's in all of them. So I don't know if you remember the book and the movie, The Secret, and the whole gist of The Secret is it's not been a secret. It's been out there in the time.
Hiding in plain sight, so to speak. I do really think that the ancients, living in a different world, a slower world, probably a deeper world in many ways than we live in, I think they understood this intuitively a lot easier than we did. And I think we have forgotten what they know. And a lot of the ancient writings reveal this. So when we go back, rather than putting the old timers into our heads and trying to assume that they were thinking like we think, I think we have to do just the opposite. We have to go through and read them with fresh eyes and fresh ears and understand that they were living in a different world, but perhaps they understood things better than we do.
Yeah, I think so too. And you know, at the heart of it, I mean, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, all of the major books are mystical. It's metaphysical. All of it is mystical. We, I think, have morphed it in a giant game of telephone and gotten it horribly wrong.
That's a wonderful way of putting it, I think. I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. And life is mystical. I mean, it's full of mystical things. We sometimes call them coincidence, but serendipity is a mystical experience. And coincidence, I don't think there is such a thing as coincidence. If we just open our eyes and see it for what it is, we can understand that at root, at basis, life is mystical. We've got to recapture that somehow. We've lost the mysticism. I was watching an old segment of The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yeah.
And here's Greg. Oh, what's his name? Wolowitz. What's his first name?
I've never seen the show, but I know what you're talking about.
Oh, Wolowitz is doing magic tricks and everything else. And Sheldon is there saying, oh, no, magic is just a deception of this and this. And Wolowitz yells out, I'm saying believe in magic, you muggle. And Harry Potter comes right out of the thing. Yeah, I think we got to start doing that.
I think it was Einstein who said that we can see things as one of two ways. One is that everything is a miracle, and one way is that nothing is a miracle.
Yeah.
But I think that the real juice of life is when we see things that are miracles, and we understand.
Yeah.
And that's where we get the most out of life, and that's where we're really living to our fullest, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. We live in a scientific age, but still, you know, science cannot explain things like love. They can explain what it does, but how do you take love and put it under a microscope? You can't do it.
These ineffable things. Okay, so in this book, The Near-Death Experiences, there's been so many books about near-death experiences, first of all, right? So what sets your book apart? What is different that we will find here that we don't find in some of the other books?
Most of the other books that I've read, and one of the reasons I wanted to make this book a little different, most of the other books are kind of either or. They either tell you the stories, which are wonderful, and I'm not criticizing it at all. Just hearing those stories. Wonderful. I don't care who you are. You can't listen to Ibn Alexander tell his story of his near-death experience, just telling it without being moved. And a lot of books do that. There are other books that try to explain the science of it. What's going on in the brain? A consciousness emerges from the brain, they say. I don't believe that at all, but that's what they say. Or our emotions are caused by neurons firing off and kicking off chemicals, which do this or that. And that's fine too, because some of those are scientific realities we have to face. What I wanted to do was to bring the mystical, to bring the story into the age of science. And understand that if these experiences are true, and I believe they are, if these experiences are true, then there is some kind of way of verifying it. Perhaps not through the science that we understand, but to bring it into the open so we can begin to look at it and say, how do we explain this? Because if we can take something as mystical as a near-death experience, and if we can look at it and examine it, and realize that it's true, it's real, then all of a sudden, our lives take on a whole new meaning. We say, oh, this isn't just a woo-woo, new age kind of thing. You know, this is reality. And oh, if we could study this kind of stuff rather than some of the other stuff we waste money on studying, science and studying, then all of a sudden, things would change, I think. If it's real, we have to know it and understand it. And that's important, I think.
It is. And to your point about purpose, how can we have war? How can we have racism?
Yeah.
You're looking at that bigger picture. except I suppose as a learning experience, but would we even need that if we understood?
Yeah. All of the isms, whether it's racism or sexism or any of these things that are just so real, and they're bogging us down, and we're putting all of our energy and all of our resources into the wrong thing. Instead of seeking how to keep people down, we have to be seeking how to liberate them. And one of the greatest liberation things is to realize we're all going to die. Presidents, kings, and street sweepers, and homeless people, we're all going to die. And at that point, every single one of us is equal. And why not start to look at that? And because that's not some kind of a intellectual exercise. That is just a scientific fact. Everyone is going to die. And at that moment, we are all equal. We've all come here to gain experience. Some of us have had other kinds of experiences than others, but we've gained that experience. Now, how can we make life better by preparing for that? Like my friend who said, I did everything but prepare for the moment of my death. Why can't we do that? I think it's so important. Just so important.
Yeah. And now there are things called death doulas, which we've had doulas for birth for in memoriam, but now we have people who actively study the process of dying and help people to do that, to prepare and to, which I think is so needed.
Yeah, I think the medical establishment really has to be congratulated. They may have come late to the party, but I think they're here now. They're starting to do experiments. I've been in places where somebody has died and come back, and the first thing they want to do is shush me out of the room so they can come in and interview this person while the memories are still clear in their head. I've seen them set up experiments in operating rooms where they have signs that can be only seen from the ceiling looking down, that with words on them. And so that when somebody dies and has that experience of floating above and coming back and looking down, then they say, what was on the papers? That kind of thing. So I think that the medical establishment is really starting to take this seriously. And I'm really thankful for people like Raymond Moody and Dr. Bruce Gryson and Eben Alexander, you know, all doctors, all who say, let's study this and find out what's going on. It's an important piece of work.
I think so too. And so important for our human experience, which I think we need to understand even more fully, especially now.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift gears just a little bit. Before we started recording, you were talking about the out-of-body experience being kind of, can you say a bit why you said that?
When I had my first out-of-body experience, I wasn't really seeking it, but I wasn't really rejecting anything like that either. I was meditating. I had come under the influence of one of the great teachers of out-of-body experiences of our generation, Dr. William Buhlmann. And I had also gone up to the Monroe Institute to study there with Bill for a while. And he was of the opinion, and he kept telling us that if you spend 30 minutes a day with intention, 30 minutes a day for 30 days meditating, trying to have an out-of-body experience and using some of the techniques that he would teach us, he said, you'll have an out-of-body experience. And I found out he was right. If I had stopped at day 28, I never would have had one. But I mean, you have to make it first in your life. And it's a simple thing, really. It's just hard to do. But it's a simple thing to understand that this perception fence, these five senses that we have, you know, taste, touch, hearing, smell, you know, that kind of thing, that's how we've learned to relate to the world. But it's possible through meditation and through other things. I've never tried, for instance, any drugs. I've never done anything like mushroom or ayahuasca or any of that stuff. But people have, and the old shamans used to use that in drumming. A lot of people use drumming without realizing it. I remember the old rock and roll song, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. And I think to a certain extent, people used to go to dances so they could have that feeling of just escaping.
Done that.
Yeah. But with me, it was just through meditation. And when I had my first out-of-body experience, it didn't last very long because I finally found I was over and I was so shocked to be able to realize I was out of my body. I said, wow, I did it. And of course, I was flashed right back in again. But over the years, I learned how to control it a little bit. And I would learn wonderful things. But that was the important thing, learning. The out-of-body experience is central to shamanism. Shamanism through drumming or through sometimes chemical things or mushrooms or natural things, they would actually leave their body. But they wouldn't leave their body to get a thrill. That wasn't the purpose of it. They were doctors. They were physicians. They would look at the patient, and they didn't know how to treat the patient. They wanted to know, what herbs should I use? What methods should I use? And so they would have these out-of-body experiences, but the purpose of it was to go and consult with the higher entities who knew what was going on, receive the information that they needed for a practical cure, and then come back and administer that cure. That was the essence of shamanism. And I think when you go back 40,000 years into the great painted caves of Western Europe, and now even beyond, we've even found places in Africa that go way back before that. And when you see those great paintings way back under the earth, half a mile under the earth, where it's dangerous and dark and dank, and I can't think any more words that begin with D, so I'll leave it there. But they would go back there, and I think they would have these out-of-body experiences, and then they would paint them on the walls. And that's why some of them are almost like psychedelic, because they're trying to put on the wall in paint in a dark place, like the womb of the earth. They would go back and try to explain this in a way that words can't explain. And they would try to project them out with a painting. And that's as old as the human race when you come right down to it.
Yeah, it is. Now, you had said that the very last bit of your book had something to do about the
purpose.
And
yeah, it was an out-of-body experience that I had.
Yeah.
What had happened was I had grown into the habit of contacting a spirit guide, who I won't go into the reasons why, but I call him Sabuko. And he's been my constant companion, daily companion now for, 12, 13, 14 years. And the reason, I think, is not that he's a separate entity on the other side just waiting around for me to call on him. I think he's actually me on the other side. I think it's actually that essence of who I was that I left on the other side of the Higgs field. And he is the spiritual reality of me that I sometimes have had lost contact with, because on this side, I just kept following as I was taught, as all we were taught, following your perceptions, your intuitions. I mean, not following your intellect and following your senses and all this kind of stuff. But through out-of-body experiences, I learned how to cross over that fence, to peek over that fence. And I met him one day when I was wondering, I had just begun to start writing books here. And I found myself saying, is this something I'm supposed to do? What is the purpose of my life? And in meditation, I was pulled to this circle where I believe this entity, where I first met him, it was a stone circle. It's an ancient stone circle that people were making stone tools there thousands of years ago. And he was in spirit. He was waiting for me and took me up to the place that I now call the shaman circle. It's where I believe shamans, spirit beings, still gather. And I have a regular place now at that place. But there was an experience where the man I call grandfather, the teaching elder of the shaman circle, would sit in the middle. And in my out-of-body experience, I took my accustomed place, and he gave us what I call a block of teaching. It wasn't word for word. It comes out as a solid block that just all of a sudden we understand something in its totality. And I tried to recapture that as soon as I got out of my out-of-body experience. I tried to write it down. And near as I can best, this is a pale representation of what happened, but near as I can understand, he was giving us a lesson, a teaching about the purpose of life. And as I wrote it in my book, he said something like this: the lesson today is about the meaning of life. A rich man entered a village and offered a reward to anyone who could reveal to him the meaning of life. Well, a prominent teacher came forward and said, the meaning of life is found in love. That may be so, said the rich man, but I cannot make myself love what I consider to be unlovable. Best I can do is pretend to feel what I do not feel. Surely the meaning of life cannot be found in falsehood. And he dismissed the prominent teacher. Then a successful businessman stepped forward and he said, the meaning of life is to be found in activity. Busy people are successful people, and successful people are happy. But I find happiness in leisure as well, said the rich man. Surely the meaning of life is not to be found only in activity, for many active people know deep down that they live lives without meaning, despite their success. And the businessman walked away. Then a poor man approached the rich man. He was a beggar, despised by all. The meaning of life, he said, is found in the knowledge of the certainty of death. Explain, said the rich man. The poor man continued, only when you know that death is imminent, when you know it is at your very doorstep, can you come to really feel the moment you are in right now. For you realize it may be your last experience of life. The present moment becomes crystal clear, sharp, and vivid. The meaning of life is to be found in fully experiencing the clarity of every living moment. That, after all, is why we choose to be born in the first place. The poor beggar won the reward. He had revealed the meaning of life. And that's really why I wrote this book, because as anyone who hears these words, when you draw your final breath, as you cross the boundary into a world that is your home, your source, and your destination, may you have found both the meaning and purpose of your life. And to that, I can only say namaste.
That is beautiful. You know, it's so funny. I was just speaking with a friend this morning about meaning and Joseph Campbell. So that is interesting that we talk about the coincidences, the synchronicities.
Joseph Campbell said those beautiful words. He said, people say we're looking for the meaning of life. He said, I don't think so. I don't think people are looking for the meaning of life. They're looking for the experience of being alive. And I think that's why we're here, really.
I think so, too. Yeah, my guys have told me all the time that we have to put the experience in the human experience, and we have to put the human in the human experience.
Yeah.
We are uniquely poised to live this type of school here on Earth. Which is fascinating. So, Jim, where can we go to find out more about you, more about your book?
My website is www.jimwillis.net. And all the books are there and a lot of other things. And it also has my Facebook page on there. And it has my YouTube page. I've got a lot of YouTube videos that we record that talk about these very things. I was very fortunate in 6 years ago, my daughter left her life behind and came up here. I built her a house through the woods so she can have her own house in the woods. But she's also takes care of all of my the technical stuff that I don't understand and all the scheduling and all this stuff. So all I have to do is worry about writing and she handles all the details. I'm very fortunate to have her here, but she takes care of the website. And on the website also, there is a contact page and you can write to me. And I'd love to hear, you know, you and I can talk to each other and but we don't know who else is out there, and I love to meet them. So feel free to contact me. I know I came out here to get away from everything, but I'll make an exception in the case of anybody who is part of the community that wants to explore these kinds of things. So www.jimwillis.net, and all the books are there, and all the reviews are there, both good and bad, and all the media stuff, and you can spend hours on there if you want.
And I will add just a couple of things, you know, on that YouTube section in your website, you can add this because, of course, we're going to be on YouTube with this
interview. Oh, that's great. I'll tell Jan and she'll take care of it then.
On there. Perfect. That'd be wonderful. And then second of all, a standing invitation to all of our listeners of the Radiate Wellness podcast. Please contact our guests. They would love to hear from you. And it'd be great to say, hey, I heard you on the Radiate Wellness podcast. That would be such a joy, right?
Real good.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Jim. This has been a great conversation.
I've enjoyed it.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I'd love to have you back on for other books and we'll see if we can arrange that. All right.
We'll do it. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Radiate Wellness is an international community of holistic and alternative healers, dedicated to helping you create spiritual, energetic, and physical well-being. To learn more about our practitioners, services, classes, and events, or to schedule an appointment, visit us at radiatewellnesscommunity.com.